Yeah, I think this is the time in New Zealand where we had a lot of hits that were covers of overseas tunes, like this one by, was it Engelbert Humperdinck, was it? Neil Sedaka, sorry, yeah. But that sort of thing, you know, these sort of croony songs where some, because they didn't have music videos, they couldn't ship over from overseas, the best way to perform them on TV over here was to get some good-looking, you know, local lad to mash them out on Top of the Pops or whatever it was, you know, the Come On, the Pete Sinclair-hosted shows of the 60s and that. Yeah, so I think that's why.
Susan, you heard of this track?
No, I'm clearly too young for any of this.
Now, I'm with the person who's washing her hair less. Most hairdressers advise less daily. Also, skin biome is important. Skin biome?
6 weeks, don't wash your face.
Yeah. We are kind of obsessive washing culture now, says Francis. Wallace, couple of points. One, prescriptions were not required for margarine. Two, only smelly or sweaty people need a shower every day. One 10 to 20 minute shower per week is all that's needed. Susan?
Could you not sort of separate the 20 minutes up into at least like five lots of four or something?
Yeah, exactly. Just take a 20 minute shower.
I mean, that's a long time. What are you doing for 20 minutes?
That's 10 Wallace showers. You could shower noon and night every week, you know. Yeah, no. And only smelly people. Well, maybe people that actually get outside and do stuff.
If Susan feels she needs to shower twice a day, she should get professional.
Okay. Can I please explain this?
Yeah.
All right. So I exercise every morning, right? So you need to have a shower after that, clearly.
Yeah.
And then you're running around all day. And as you said, sometimes it's humid. You're wearing suits and everything.
Exactly.
Isn't it the polite thing to do before you get into bed to just freshen up? I mean, how can you argue with that?
Sure. I mean, look, no one's judging you, Susan, apart from what's his name?
Apparently there are people.
Quite a few. Colin.
Colin, apart from Colin.
Right, and finally here, the wage freeze in 1976 to 77, Mulder, and economic lunacy, says Murray. Companies offered company cars to junior managers and department heads. Price control also in place and vehicle costs guaranteed increase in wholesale prices. Thank you very much for a big response this afternoon. Two showers a day, goodness me, a product of the me generation. But I'm going to...
I wish. I'm very pleased with that.
A lot of hate with the two showers, but I'm going to say right now, because I'll feel hypocritical if I don't say that I also have two showers. That's why I have very small showers. They're under 2 minutes, because I too go to the gym and you cannot have a shower.
Can I just add that with this really effective thing, back when we were allowed to go overseas, I went to Italy in 2019, and there was a shower in this place we were staying in, this hotel, that as you showered, it would tell you how much you used, and it would give you a grade on how eco-friendly your shower was. So you'd start off with an A+. After literally, I think, 30 seconds, you were down to an A-. And then by the time I'd sort of, you know, kind of washed under my arms, I'm at a C. And I don't want to tell. I don't think it goes down far further than about a G or so. But you know, an 8 minute shower,
like I'm there.
Know, yeah,
that's smart
that was,
home.
It was good though. Cause it just guilts you.
Now to this, there will be many who are familiar with the scenario. You decide to do some renovations, maybe do up the kitchen or add a room. You book a builder, get the quote. Then the reno happens, and the initial price has increased markedly. Finance Minister Grant Robinson says the Commerce Commission will investigate the building materials sector after its supermarket investigation, and yesterday indicated a strong political appetite to examine high building material costs. We pay far too much for building supplies, Minister Robinson said. So with us to discuss is John Tukey, who is Professor of Construction Management at Auckland University of Technology. Professor Tukey, kia ora, welcome.
Good evening. How are you?
Good, thank you. So the building sector is the next cab off the rank after supermarkets. Do you feel there is a need for some sort of probe?
I'm fine with it. Actually, a lot of construction people are fine with it. It's a case of let's put this to bed, please. Let's stop the narrative around we're being rorted around the construction materials prices. There's a lot of other issues driving house prices. And materials is, relatively speaking, small beer.
Right. Minister Grant Robinson said you only need to look across to New South Wales, Victoria, to see how different it could be. What does he mean there?
Well, he's talking for a basket of construction materials, but the reality is that we are a small island nation with large internal costs associated with delivery and maintenance of stocks around a very large country. The same size of population of New Zealand is packed into Sydney, for example, about 5 million. They need 400 builders merchants to support all of Greater Sydney. We need 850-odd builders merchants to supply New Zealand. We have higher overhead costs. We have higher transportation costs. This is an inherent component of doing business in a small island nation.
So when the Productivity Commission has suggested, as they did, we pay 20 to 30% more for building materials than they do in Australia, are they right? Are they taking the whole picture into account or what?
You've got to look at the market conditions that exist here in New Zealand compared to Australia. It's a different proposition. The economies of scale are not the same. The conditions are not even the same. And I'm not carrying water for any particular builder or stockist or anything else. You know, the reality is that you can't compare like for like in quite the rather naive way that is being proposed. But let's do it. Let's do the comparison. Let's find out what the situation is and put the issue to bed.
Jump to you, Damien. Yeah. Is
Auckland, I mean, you look at the scale of Auckland, obviously we're not the size of Sydney, but we're not massively different. In Auckland, should it be cheaper to get these materials than it is elsewhere in the country? I can understand why shipping something to Invercargill might cost more, but why not in Auckland?
Well, it should be. There are conditions here. We do have a certain amount of scale associated with the market that we have. But again, I would welcome the inquiry and to put the issue to bed. The problem, unfortunately, is if we find the negative, and we find that there is nothing to see here, move along. It's not going to shut anybody up. The story will continue. I mean, it's always going to carry on this way because somebody's been proved wrong or. Maybe prove wrong.
I was talking to an architect the other day about this very matter, and we were talking about forestry and wood here, and the fact that we actually import most of our wood because our forests in large part have overseas owners, and our wood gets shipped off to China, and then we have to import the wood. You know, and just sort of how ridiculous that is. Is that part of the problem?
Well, it certainly is part of it. We have higher labour costs here. There's no question about that. We also have.
Higher than Australia?
The hourly rates are commensurate. They, because of how they do certain aspects of their building, they get higher levels of productivity, which is you know something to be looked at as well. But it's again, I would caution an expectation of a wholesale, you know, 20% reduction in prices because. This is, in effect, what's been touted by what's been said by the minister.
Susan.
Yeah, what I'd be interested to know is, and it might come out of an investigation, is this a supply and demand issue where the people with these products are using that as an opportunity to hike the prices, or is this about the difficulty in getting the material to the location? Because if it is a supply and demand issue and therefore has increased significantly over the last few years, then I think there is a problem. If, on the other hand, John, it's just really all about the difficulty in getting it to the particular location, then that's just a fact of living in New Zealand.
Well, there's a little from column A and a little from column B on this one. There is some inherent problems associated with what's happening courtesy of stimulus, wage support schemes, changes in behaviours around COVID and all the rest of it. There's a lot of money sloshing around in the economy. A lot of demand is being expedited into construction taking place. Again, all of this positive when you're dealing with a housing shortage. The downside is that inevitably we are capacity constrained. So there will be people who will take a position. There are companies that are, you know, they've committed themselves, they've forward committed themselves to supply certain materials at certain prices going forward, and you know if you've got your orders in early, as a lot of the larger builders will have done to secure their supply chain for the next 12 months or so, inevitably it's going to have eruptions on what's left.
I was going to say, well, it's just regard to the intro when you said, you know, you get a quote from a builder and the quote's this much and whatnot. I think that's a different issue. Unless you're building the Sky City Convention Centre and it's taking four years and the prices go up, I think that's just, you know, maybe someone underquoting in order to get the job and knowing they can, or, you know, or thing other something else going on there maybe.
It's certainly a concern in the building industry. You know, the issue with building is getting the job is easy, making it pay is hard. So very often when people put in, or you know, various builders put in different quotes, the winning bid, as in the lowest bid, actually has missed out the most, and you end up having to re-tender quite significantly. This is fairly common, but unfortunately, what we have is a bit of a perfect storm, in the sense of constrictions in the supply chain coming from Australia and elsewhere into China, because we've got a reduction in shipping capacity coming into New Zealand. We've got a finite capacity of production indigenous within New Zealand. So we can't, you know, so many timber mills, for example, have been closed down over the last 15, 20 years. And the concentration of for cost efficiency purposes has been at larger mills, where it's where you've got you try to maximise the output from these particularly larger facilities, but you can't scale them quickly, and you can't step them up without putting on extra shifts, which increases your costs per unit, which negates the cost benefit associated with doing the larger production unit. So what we have is a massively complex set of circumstances that we're dealing with.
Okay. Professor of Construction Management at Auckland University of Technology, John Tukey. Appreciate that, John. Thank you. 15 to 5, the panel, RNZ National, Damien Christie and Susan Hornsby-Gallup with me today. The number of people charged with drug use and possession each month has dropped dramatically, and there's less bias against Māori. That is according to a report by Dira Ching in the New Zealand Herald, which looks at how police have used their discretion from November last year to February this year, and follows the law change which clarified that police shouldn't prosecute for drug use if a therapeutic approach would be more beneficial to the public interest. Figures obtained by the Herald found that those who faced being charged with drug use or possession as their most serious offence, 20% were charged. That's compared to a third of people being charged in the 12 months before the law change. Now, for Māori, the figures show 37% were charged before the law change. That dropped to 22% in the 4 months following the election. So to discuss is Drug Foundation Chief Executive Sarah Helm. Kia ora, Sarah.
Oh, kia ora.
You've had a look at these figures. What stands out to you?
Yeah, look, I'd also love to talk about my renovations, just listening to the builder.
Yes, exactly. Many do.
I'll talk about the drug issues. So, we're very pleased with the improvements. I just want to start by saying that. And, you know, it's definitely the change we want. It's heading in the right direction, but we still do have some concerns. So, essentially, as you've said, there's been a reduction in convictions where possession was the most serious offence. So it's very specifically about that, as opposed to people who have other charges or something else that's happened. And we've seen essentially a drop from about 920 people annually to 580 New Zealanders every year. That's still quite a few people, even just with that very specific caveat. And we've definitely seen an improvement in percentage of Māori, and that positive improvement in health referrals. That's all great. It's definitely a change we want. However, if you look right across, change isn't happening right across the system. So conviction rates have actually only fallen by about 11% if you compare 2020 to 2018, which is before the change happened. And a particularly astounding stat is that of those who are sent to court for low-level drug offences, 43.6% are Māori.
Right.
So we're still seeing Māori unfairly being picked up and put through the system and convicted.
Okay, well, keep going.
Yes. So it's very specifically, essentially, police are exercising their discretion for people with no other charges or for whom the drug charge was the most serious offence, and specifically for cannabis.
We have a panellist here, Sarah, so let's bring them in. Sarah Hornsby-Gallup, what do you think?
Look, I think that the movement towards less charging people in prosecution is really great. The slightly difficult piece of that is that it's confusing. Like, if you're now saying that 20 or 10% of people who are caught in possession of cannabis are charged for it, that's the exception or not the rule. Yeah, in other words, it's basically sort of default decriminalisation. Now, whether or not that's a good thing, it's confusing for those who are charged with trying to enforce enforce the rules. And the Police Association President Chris Cahill has said that. He said police are understandably confused about how they should exercise their discretion. So, you know, if we are moving towards effectively decriminalisation, then it would be very interesting to see in the next year or two, if we did have another referendum, what the outcome of that might be, because I suspect it might be different.
We already know, I mean, from what I've seen, the research, I mean, the referendum result, for one thing, which wasn't about decriminalisation, was, you know, 49% odd in favour of legalisation. The decriminalisation, all the research shows that it's way higher than that. The problem is here that it's still being left up to the police to decide when this decriminalisation, de facto decriminalisation, applies or not. And we can still see that it applies unfairly to some people over others. Yeah, I'm really interested in what Sarah has to say about that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So almost 40% of people who voted no support decrim. So you have a large majority of people who support decrim. But moreover, you know, not having that surety around the law means that for your users, they aren't able to be honest about their drug use. And that causes huge problems. It means that you're burying this problem underground. You're not having conversations with your loved ones about it. They're the people who are going to tell you when you're messing up, right? And you're certainly not necessarily reaching out for help either. And so we really want to see a change in that. And surety around the law, if it's decriminalised, would allow for us to actually truly build a health-based response.
I wonder that Andrew Little's going to take this sort of, you know, this report out and say, well, there's a good reason that we don't need to do anything, because he seems to be really keen just to abrogate his responsibilities and not make any meaningful change to drug law.
Susan?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, it doesn't seem that we're achieving either objective in that case at this point, because people aren't getting rehabilitation and the help that they necessarily need at the front end, because, as Sarah says, they have to be silent about their use. And at the other end, nor are we actually punishing people, not that I think we should be punishing people, but there doesn't seem to be any point to the law as it currently stands.
And the sort of change we're talking about has been called for by the Law Commission for over 10 years, and it's been, you know, a decrim model has been in place in Portugal very successfully for over two decades. So the change as well, you know, the time has come. Yeah.
Okay. Drug Foundation Chief Executive Sarah Helm, appreciate your time, Sarah. Thank you very much. How can John, quite a big response regarding the building, because people can relate to the Renault story there.
Sure.
How can John explain a 4,500 square metre rate for a new house with easy access? !
We'll get him back on now. Let's get him.
Johnny is still there. I believe there's collusion going on in construction, especially when builders' quotes are virtually the same price, says Sam, quite a bit about that. We might even come back to that particular issue.
Wallace, just one thing that I was going to ask John, but we ran out of time, whether you can actually enforce a quote. Yeah, if you're given an estimate, then surely the estimate can and will change. But if it's a quote, I'd like to know whether that's set in stone.
There's often wiggle room with quotes, isn't there? They can say, well, yeah, but you did say, actually, can we move that letterbox 1 metre out, please? Or can we have that driveway slightly wider? There's often something where they can point to you having, you know, made an adjustment or agreed with them about some alteration.
Exactly. And I must say this too, that person who confidently said that margarine wasn't prescription, David says, I'm a retired hospital pharmacist and I can clearly recall margarine only being available on prescription.
This is where the fight's going to be 90s. Today.
That's the frontier. Margarine prescription or not.
Let's just turn over the last. We've got 7 minutes left. Let's just turn it over to the margarine battle, shall we?
No, because I want to talk about this very important topic. And a family desperately want their dogs back. Yeah. Based in Brighton near Dunedin, they have enlisted a plane, a drone, and a search and rescue team to look for a pair of missing dogs, and say they will not stop searching until they find their beloved pets, reports Wyatt Ryder for the Otago Daily Times. Rowan Newman said her Border Terrier dogs, Floss, aged 2, and Scruff, aged 3, went missing on April the 30th. The children would move heaven and earth to get them back, so we thought we'd put in a call. And Rowan Newman is with us on the line from Brighton, Dunedin. Rowan, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. So Floss, aged 2, Scruff, tell us how they went missing.
Yeah, so it was the 30th, which was the Friday, and the children were on school holidays, and they were just down playing in our gully with their friends, and the two dogs wandered down about 200 metres away from the house and we were with the children, and the children all came up at different times, thinking that each other had the two dogs, and then I realised that they must have went chasing rabbit, possibly, yeah. This, so that's how they left our section.
Yeah. This is quite a sizable audience, and you know, may or may not help. Can you explain just where they went missing?
So they were missing Big Stone Road in Brighton, and we're on a lifestyle block surrounded by other lifestyle blocks, and just across the road on the right-hand side is a forestry, which is Hope Hill Forestry, owned by Juanita, which is where I did my, you know, a lot of the search.
Mm. Rowan, how are the kids taking it?
Really bad, really, really bad, especially my oldest son, who's 11. Scruff, the older dog, the male fop dog, was his rock and like his therapy dog, who he slept with every night and just adores. Yeah. So, and they're just not sleeping well at night, by all the kids. We're just looking after the six puppies that the female dog had left, you know, which is very unusual.
We've got a panel here. They might have some questions for you too, there, Rowan, Susan.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't actually have any questions because I'm not a dog person, so I don't really have the same sort of level of understanding.
You go for it. Yeah, I was going to ask you, look, you've had a search by a plane, a drone and a search and rescue team.
Correct.
You desperately want the dogs back.
That's right.
No clues at all yet.
No, nothing, absolutely nothing. Just mysteriously disappeared. They've got fantastic recall, the dogs, and they're a huge part of our family.
Is there any part of you that think, I mean, and I don't want to put this in your head, because just living in the suburbs where we do with cats, you know, you hear stories of cats being taken and used for things like that, you know, or kidnapped or whatever it is. Is there any reason to suspect that it's anything more than them getting lost?
Yeah, possibly. I do feel like at the moment I've just, there's a lot of puppies being stolen, dogs being stolen, so that is definitely, you know, part of my search, because they're either lost or stolen. So they're my two avenues that I've been searching down, definitely.
There is a reward involved, Rowan.
Yes, that's correct. There's a $1,000 reward for their return.
Okay. So for those who are listening, what's the message? If you think you might know where Floss and Scruff is in Brighton, Dunedin, what's the message?
Just please return them to the vets, even, you know, a vet or the police station or myself on Big Stone Road, or get in touch with me. My cell phone's on all the flyers that I've been sending out in the newspaper, the flyers there, and that my phone number on it. So it's just, yeah. If you could get them back, would be great.
And good luck.
Good luck, Rowan. All the
best. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Rowan Newman there. Yeah, I mean, it's fair enough, Susan, saying, you know, because before I had a pet, I wasn't quite sure of that sort of, I guess, that the company that you'd keep with pets. But now that I've got Little Banjo, I mean, I can't. It's a real special love, isn't it, Damien, you know, with your pets. You've got cats.
Yeah, we've got two very, very cuddly cats that come in and, and sort of sleep with me at night and put their heads on, you know, on my legs or something like that. And just, they're not total lap cats, but they definitely come in and give you a nice cuddle. And they, I couldn't, you know, we've had one of them go missing for a little while when we moved houses, so I know what that's like. It's not nice. Mm.
I saw the picture of the family and the little baby dogs. They did look very cute.
Yeah. So all the best, let's hope. But back to the issues of showering.
Can we not end the show on the missing dogs, please?
Because they have just rolled through. Showering less often doesn't mean bad smells. I stopped using soap in the shower about 5 years ago, Susan. Instead, daily I use a flannel and handmade liquid using a dried South American berry. I haven't need to use deodorant since. So... Mm.
It's a matter of interpretation, but I'm concerned about how this is all very directed at myself.
No, it's a team effort.
Here we go. Look, more than a decade before, in 1972, the requirement for a prescription in order to obtain polyunsaturated margarine was removed by an amendment to the Margarine Act 1908. There you go.
We've discovered it. Kua muriti hōtaka mō tēnā rā, kia pai, tō koutou pō. The program's finished for this afternoon. I'm back with you tomorrow. See you then.